Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, I'll be focusing on the political and social situation I found in Jerusalem during my recent visit to the Holy Land. On the political front, we'll be hearing from the head of the Quartet Mission, working to improve living conditions and kickstart the stalled peace process. On the social side, I'll be talking to a key figure in the Equestrian Order of the Holy Sepulchre, which runs pilgrimages and supports all kinds of aid projects for the Christian communities of the Holy Land. Building confidence and providing credibility, two essential conditions for the resumption of real peace negotiations between Palestinians and Israelis. At present, the peace process is stalled, with both sides refusing to return to the table until certain key demands are met. While on the ground, the conflict continues, with killings, reprisal attacks, house demolitions, and other forms of oppression making up the almost daily reality of the region, a reality in which many people have given up hope of a lasting and just peace. Amongst the key players working to combat this hostile climate and create conditions for a return to the negotiating table is the so-called Quartet, made up of the United Nations, the European Union, the United States and Russia, and currently headed by former British Prime Minister Tony Blair. The head of the Quartet Mission in Jerusalem, Gary Grappo, was among the people I spoke with during my recent visit to the Holy Land. He was addressing the coordination group of bishops from Europe and North America who make an annual pilgrimage to the Holy Land in support of the Christian communities there. I began by asking Ambassador Grappo what kind of progress the Quartet has been able to make.
We've had a number of successes during the period of the Quartet's mission here. I can cite just a couple of examples. When we had the problems in Gaza after the flotilla, where there was a very, very strict blockade imposed on Gaza, and necessary goods could not enter Gaza, the Quartet, under the leadership of Mr. Blair, engaged at a very senior level with the Israeli leadership to try and get them to consider different parameters for allowing certain goods, particularly humanitarian goods, to enter Gaza. And after considerable negotiation, largely on the part of Mr. Blair, we were able to achieve a new regime for the importation of humanitarian and even commercial goods into Gaza. A second example dealing with movement and access of people and goods within the West Bank and between the West Bank and Israel. We've been able to reduce the number of checkpoints, simplified some procedures. We have a great deal more work to be done in this area, but we have seen some modest successes. And we're working in a number of areas I mentioned in my meeting with the bishops. Helping to facilitate other projects that are ongoing just by the intervention of the Quartet and sometimes even Mr. Blair can be very, very effective. So we have achieved some successes which do translate to the improvement in the everyday lives of some Palestinians. Obviously, we want to make it as broad as possible.
And yet the situation in Gaza, in the West Bank, will never be able to return to normal. There will never be a real qualitative improvement until the occupation is ended. The solution to that seems further away today than ever before.
Well, clearly, that's what the Palestinian people want, and that's what I think the international community wants, is a final settlement, and many, many parties, of course, working toward that. We have the currently U.S.-led effort in trying to revive direct negotiations. That's the most essential element in this whole equation. The effort of the Quartet, although we are not the principal player, is to support that political effort, but also to help create the atmosphere that would allow for the political negotiations to proceed and ultimately conclude successfully. And we do that by addressing all of these areas, building confidence on the part of the Palestinians in terms of their ability to interact with the Israelis and achieve some progress in their negotiations with the Israelis. And that's where most of our focus is, in improving the lives of the Palestinian people, both West Bank and Gaza, which also would entail the improvement in the overall political climate that would facilitate negotiations between the two sides.
How much is this a question of leadership, both on the Israeli and the Palestinian side? Because the current Palestinian president and prime minister seem to be widely acclaimed as the kind of men who are prepared to make compromise, to move ahead. How much is it a question of personalities?
Well, we can never discount the importance of leadership, whether on the Palestinian side or on the Israeli side, or even the international community and how it engages in this issue, without question. It's vital that we have a strong commitment on the part of the leaderships of the various parties to the two-party solution and to the negotiation process. Now, we don't quite have all the elements together yet, but certainly from the perspective of the Palestinian leadership, there's a genuine commitment on the part of President Abbas and certainly the Prime Minister Fayyad to all the things that they can do, that they have control of, to build the Palestinian state. Nevertheless, they have established some conditions for renewing the negotiations, and of course that's presented a problem in terms of the current impasse because we can't get agreement on the Israeli side. I think through the offices of the United States, there will be an effort to find another way to go at this issue and to, first of all, get indirect talks moving forward so we can address some of these key issues. And then at some later stage, when the confidence is there, when the comfort is there, when sides recognize that it's necessary, have the direct negotiations that are ultimately necessary to reach final agreement.
What do you think can put pressure on the Israeli side? It seems to be moving further and further away from a real desire, a real will to pursue this, a political solution.
I'm not sure that it's necessarily a question of putting pressure on the Israelis. Both sides face challenges within their own camps, which make negotiations problematic. We know that. But it is very much a question of the two sides exerting the necessary leadership, taking the risks, which everyone recognizes are going to be there, to advance this process. As I mentioned to the bishops, we have learned very painfully after however many years we've been working this issue that delaying, postponing, addressing this doesn't make it easier. It makes it more difficult. It complicates it. And we certainly are facing a very, very complicated picture today in terms of trying to reach a final settlement.
The Palestinians are calling on international governments around the world to recognize the state of to recognize the Palestinian state, and they are increasingly doing that. Is this having any effect? Is it a good thing in your view?
That's for them to judge. Practically speaking, the way you address this problem ultimately is for the two sides to sit down at a table and negotiate a solution. Yes, it's nice to have the international community behind you, but at the end of the day, you don't reach agreement by others agreeing with your point of view. You reach an agreement because you and the other side have come to an understanding, and that's what we want to achieve.
You say you remain an optimist despite this very complex and difficult situation. What gives you most hope?
Well, first of all, because there is no other solution. That the two-state solution is the only way for these two states, these two countries, to what we want to be two countries, to move forward and provide their people with both the security and the prosperity that they deserve. And because there is no other alternative, we have to keep focused on working within the construct of a two-state solution. Secondly, I think both Israelis and Palestinians recognize the need and want this to happen. And so it's therefore incumbent on diplomats and others to find a way to do that, to take the risks, to make the hard decisions, and find a way to reach an understanding and or hopefully a final agreement.
My thanks there to Ambassador Gary Grappo, who heads the Quartet mission in Jerusalem. Despite the lack of progress towards a political solution, there are many organisations in the Holy Land working to improve the daily lives of Palestinians, many of whom have lost jobs, livelihoods and contact with family and friends as a result of the so-called security wall which Israel began constructing in 2003. Among those organisations is the Equestrian Order of the Holy Sepulchre, which dates back to the days of the Crusades, but now works in countries all over the world to raise awareness and fund projects for the small Christian communities in Israel and the Palestinian territories. Dr. Michael Whelan served as lieutenant or head of the order in the UK for many years and is now part of its general council based here in Rome. I sat down with him to find out more about the history of the order and the focus of its fundraising activities today.
The order does date back to the Crusades. Godfrey de Bouillon was the leader of the First Crusade, and his record, his sword and spurs are still held within the Holy Sepulchre Church in Jerusalem. He led the Crusade. The Crusades, after some 200 years, the knights left the Holy Land and largely were semi-dormant in Europe until 1847, when the Pope re-established the Patriarchate of Jerusalem. And he reconstituted the order and gave it the responsibility of supporting the Patriarch of Jerusalem. So since 1847, we have been a structured group of people, essentially providing finance and support. It has had its constitution modified by various popes. At one time, the Pope was the head of the order, but now it is assigned to a cardinal. So we have Cardinal John Foley at the moment as head of the order based in Rome. He is a cardinal grand master, and there is then a committee, the Grand Magisterium, which sits in Rome, and the Patriarch of Jerusalem is the grand prior. The order has some 40 to 50 lieutenancies around the world. In small countries, it is normally one lieutenancy, but for the USA, it will have four or five lieutenancies to cover the large geographical area. The numbers in a lieutenancy range from 30 to 40 in the very small ones to 1,500, 1,700 in some of the very large American or Canadian or Italian lieutenancies. And each lieutenancy is essentially independent but does operate under the jurisdiction of the Grand Magisterium. And together they provide something like $8, $9, $10 million a year into the Holy Land to support the schools, the parishes, humanitarian aid and projects and the Latin Patriarchate.
Some would say that for the 21st century, the military connotations, if you like, harking back really to the origins, to the Crusades, is entirely inappropriate. How do you respond to that?
To a large extent, the only thing that we hold from those very early days is the regalia, the cloak, and the pilgrim shell that members of the order receive from the Patriarch when they make a pilgrimage to the Holy Land. We have lost or abandoned or moved away from many of the historic traditional elements of an order. There are some that still exist. You come across them in various parts of the world where they are still trying to relive the 15th, 14th, 13th century. We've moved a long way from that, and our constitution is very clear in that respect. But we do retain the regalia, and it is quite interesting that when we come to Jerusalem, we will wear the regalia and have a special reception into the Holy Sepulchre Church, which the Franciscan community organize. It's called a solemn entry, and that perhaps is the only thing that really dates back to the occasion when a new set of knights would arrive from the UK, and there would be a great celebration and a singing of the thanks be to God that a new set of knights had come, so maybe the old ones could go home. But that is really the major traditional element, other than some formalities over the investiture of knights. I mean, by comparison, England has a formal process when they invest knights of the land, of the realm, and we have a similar procedure, although in England we are not allowed to dub the knights on the shoulder. That is prerogative of the Queen.
As you say, you're providing a lot of money, a lot of support to the church here in the Holy Land. What would you see as the major needs today, the area where you can be most effective?
The area that we are doing most of our work in is that of the education of the Christian community in the schools. If we have educated Christian people, then we're giving them the opportunity of taking a major role in the running of their country in the fullness of time. We know that by educating them, we provide them an opportunity to emigrate, but if the circumstances are such, they would wish to emigrate in any case. But in a recent visit to Jordan, when we had the privilege of meeting the King of Jordan through one of the bishops' conferences, he said that whilst the Christian community constituted some 3%, 4%, 5% of his country, in the administrative ranks, they were operating as some 24%, 25%. So they were very dependent on members of their administration who had been educated to a good level within the patriarchate schools. And perhaps this is an aspect that some people may not appreciate, that for the Christian community to be fully recognized, it does need to take a major role within the administration and organization of any country in which it's represented.
You're working amidst all kinds of difficulties here, aren't you? Largely due to the ongoing conflict between Palestinians and Israelis.
We are. Every time we come, we see a difference, and usually it is a negative difference, an impact on the lives of the Christians. We have, since the year 2000, certainly England and Wales, has made a point of visiting the parishes and the people and arranging a social evening when the locals can enjoy a meal and a conversation and a discussion with the knights that have come over. And that has been continued to a number of the diocesan pilgrimages that have taken place in recent years, because it does build bridges between the peoples of the two countries. And it is very easy to think of the Holy Land as a group of holy places which one visits on pilgrimage. But the true value out of making a pilgrimage is often stated as meeting the people, the holy people of the Holy Land rather than the holy places of the Holy Land.
You're encouraging people to come here to meet with the people. What do you think perhaps people coming on pilgrimage can learn from here? What is the greatest gift perhaps that you take back home with you after meeting with the church here?
The point that has been raised a number of times by others and myself within the pilgrimage group is when we've joined in a parish mass on a Sunday morning, the sheer pleasure on the faces of the people to see that there are others who've come to join with them, to pray with them, to share maybe just a few hours of their life. But they're not isolated. And it has been said to me that one of the biggest memories the pilgrims take back is the recognition by those over here that there are others that think about them, care for them, pray for them, and are prepared in small numbers to come over and join with them in their services. We took a photograph of a young lady in the choir in Bet Jala Church 2 or 3 months ago when we were over here. She looked so happy and just singing lustily, beautifully. And we happened to ask her afterwards, why was it that you were so happy during Mass? And she said, with all of you here, I just felt there was a joy and a celebration, and I just had to give of my best. And so she was getting something out of it, and we got a lot out of it.
There does seem to be a growing realization here that the churches, that the Christian community must help itself. Do you share that feeling?
I do. I've had lots of discussions with people about why do we just give money, which is spent, and then tomorrow they need more money to spend. And I'm encouraged, certainly in the three parishes in the Bethlehem area, where I've had some experience recently, that they are setting up St. Vincent de Paul groups, they're setting up parish support groups, where those that are fortunate to have some monies, either historical monies or from professional fees and salaries, they are prepared to help those within their own parish. And we are far happier helping somebody who is doing their best in a small way to help themselves, rather than just be seen as handing out largesse as we go around.
On the tourism front, there are increasing concerns, aren't there, about the wall and the continuing difficulties of the Palestinian people, the difficulties for pilgrims who come to Jerusalem to be able to get into Bethlehem or the surrounding areas.
That's quite a wide subject. My experience is that this is more in the minds of the people who are organizing the pilgrimages, who are perhaps doing it for their own benefit. We have been into Bethlehem, stayed in the hotels in Bethlehem, eaten meals in Bethlehem, and enjoyed meeting people in Bethlehem on every pilgrimage, especially where we have spent 2 or 3 days within the city of Bethlehem. I think it is false information to say Bethlehem is dangerous, it doesn't provide the facilities, the support. Just go in, go and have a look at the Church of the Nativity, go and look at Shepherd's Field, and then come out again and stay overnight in Jerusalem. I think that is part of the problem of the travel agents, who perhaps find it easier. They can organize things better if they have their group staying within a largely Israeli group of hotels in Jerusalem and do not take the trouble to find out what really is possible if they were concerned about supporting the Christians in Palestine.
Do you find that the political situation is increasingly encroaching upon the work that you do overall?
It's not encroaching on the work we do, other than the difficulties possibly of bringing groups into the country. But it is interesting that in a recent report to aid the pilgrimage situation, the Israelis said they were training 200 of their own guides to be able to take pilgrimage groups into Bethlehem. That by implication means that they would be taking the business of the Bethlehem guides, who at the moment do gain a little from all the groups coming in. So there is a general move, and it is associated with the social and political moves that are taking place in Israel. There's a general move to transfer the revenues and the activities of pilgrims into the hands of the State of Israel and Israeli organizations, again making it harder for the Palestinian groups to gain an income.
Do you find that on the whole, over in the UK and perhaps in other areas, in other countries where the order is present, that there is a great ignorance about the political situation, about the social and economic conditions here?
There's a great lack of information, lack of understanding. And that's why, separately from the order, we have just established a charity called Friends of the Holy Land. And the aims and objectives of that charity are first to raise awareness of the difficulties that Christians are experiencing in the Holy Land, to encourage and to provide for prayers to be offered for their intentions, and only thirdly, to generate financial support to them to aid their well-being. So awareness is a huge problem at the moment. There is very little real understanding of the situation over here. There's very little in the public press that gives the detail of what is happening. You have to read between the lines of a closure here, a closure there, a rerouting of a checkpoint, a re-establishment of the rules and regulations for the Christians travelling, even pursuing their own businesses, for instance, the tour guides and the coach drivers. Little by little, there is an encroachment on their freedom of movement, which unfortunately is lost to the general public and to the world at large.
You're hoping to establish a branch of this Friends of the Holy Land organisation in every parish, every Catholic parish up and down the country, aren't you? How can people find out more about it?
Yes, we believe there are many, many people in many, many parishes who would make a small contribution to the work of the Holy Land. We have a website, www.friendsoftheholyland. We give information there as to the work we do, how they could contribute, some of our projects, some of the opportunities we see, ways in which they can contribute in a variety of alternative activities. And we will, in the course of time, start running pilgrimages to the Holy Land to actually enable people to see where their money is going, what it's being spent on, and in that way encourage them to take a greater care and appreciation of the situation over here. To have a lady sitting, old lady, sitting in her bedroom every evening with water dripping through the roof each time it rains, and the inability, lack of a husband or son to do something practical, or lack of money to have it done for her, to have the roof repaired, it makes a huge difference to her life to have a small thing put out of the way so that then she has got a dry room for the future. We have recently run a number of small building projects which have addressed relatively small issues in various houses but have brought a wealth of support, happiness to the individuals concerned, as well as providing an income for the plumber, the decorator, the plasterer that we've employed. Another major work that's carried out recently was the establishment of a small daycare centre for elderly ladies. It just takes them 1 or 2 days a week, but it enables them to leave the house, to enjoy the company of others, to have a meal together, something that they had not done for years. It did not take a lot. It was down to the initiative of a young lady in Bethlehem who felt, in her own particular case, she was leaving her mother in the morning at 8 o'clock, coming back at 5 o'clock in the evening, and her mother would not have seen anybody, spoken to anybody. And once you are past the age of 75, 80, being part of a community and being wanted becomes a major part of your life.
My thanks there to Dr. Michael Whalen, former lieutenant of the Equestrian Order of the Holy Sepulchre in the United Kingdom and currently member of its General Council based here in Rome. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.